It's The Bill Murphy Show. A daily one-on-one 30-minute interview featuring people from all walks of life. Available daily at BillMurphyShow.com. And now, here's your host, Bill Murphy.
With your digital broadcast for Friday, March 18th, 2011. You know, I got to get that intro changed for weeks like this where it says daily. He said daily in there twice, didn't he? Well, we're not so much for the last week or so. We're doing our Music Friday episodes without fail. Love them. And today is no exception. We got a great guest standing by ready to go. Brought to you as usual by Lulu's Bait Shack, fresh Florida seafood, gigantic fishbowl drinks, and live music. Especially live original music starting up again in April once the spring break madness is over with down there at Lulu's. Just like you can't even get in the door there this week or next for that matter. But we will be resuming with some of the acts that have appeared on this show on Music Friday for some original music nights resuming in April and happening on Wednesday nights. Tonight or today we are for our Friday Music Friday show. We bring in James Lewis. We're going to New York City for today's show by telephone. What is up, my brother?
Hey, Billy, what's going on, buddy? How are you?
Let's get this right out of the way. You're kind of ailing as we speak. Are you talking to me from like from your bed?
Kind of in Brooklyn, sort of recovering from a back, a spinal surgery kind of thing that sort of snuck up on me. So I'm a little under the weather, but I'm on my feet, so to speak.
But not to turn this into a completely medical show, but is this as a result of some funky stage antics, or is this just age catching up with you?
Probably a little bit of both. But on your case, as far as like having the wrong date, I think it's because it's St. Patty's Day. Maybe you had a few too many pints, Billy.
No. We're taping a day ahead of time, so I'm actually getting the day correct.
No, anyway, this is probably some product of my childhood and whatever. We can move on, but it's I'm on the road to recovery and I'm back on my feet, no pun intended.
Were you very athletic in your younger days?
Yeah, I was. I got knocked around a lot as a kid, so I'm not surprised this kind of stuff shows up. It's pretty common, you know. So,
well, to give you the Wikipedia entry that's in the top of my head about you, we can do a little bit of your history and you can add to it and correct me if I'm wrong. You have been at one of the touring singers for that fantastic Trans-Siberian Orchestra tour for how many years now?
The first year on board was 2004.
Okay.
And I've been involved with them before that, but they didn't have a track record back then, and I was supposed to sing on the first record, and I was deathly ill and had laryngitis, lost the gig, and then, you know, as these things normally don't come back around again, came back around in 2004, sang on the Lost Christmas Eve record, and then, you know, it went on from there. So I've been involved with them since probably somewhere around 1991, and then in 2004, got back on board and started the tour. So up until now.
So you're not only a touring musician for them, you have appeared on the records. I did not realize that.
Yeah, I sang a solo song on The Lost Christmas Eve, and then the rest of the records, just some background stuff. But yeah, I have one track on, which is Christmas Nights in Blue, on The Lost Christmas Eve record, which was the last record.
Very, very cool. All right, well, we'll revisit the whole Trans-Siberian Orchestra thing at length here, but let's also talk about some of the other bands that you've played with. I know there's been a number of them since, wow, I mean the 80s and beyond, right. But which ones of note would you like to recognize and remember during this interview? Because I know there might be some that you care not to remember, right?
No, I mean, oh, yeah, there is, actually. And we know the inside track on that, but it's funny, even, you know, your brother, like Steve, who either people know or don't.
Yet another guest on Music Friday with a connection to my brother, so there's...
There you go, yeah, Steve Murphy, who's an awesome drummer and one of my best friends. He was... We were in a band called Blue House, which almost got its legs. It was probably my favorite band that we had, or I had together, and it was with him. And we knocked on a lot of doors for a long time, and then Kurt Cobain came around and gave rock and roll an enema, and sort of changed everything. And
yeah,
that sort of put everything from the Black Crowes to anything swampy and bluesy like we were doing. Just sort of kicked it aside and changed things, you know, changed the landscape of music. And so we revamped and I moved on. then I think we just reached the end of our rope. We had a lot of time and money invested, and it just wore us out, you know.
Everybody's got that story where that almost made it story, and there's usually some sort of a big act involved that the record companies end up shifting their attention to something else, and you get put on the back burner. And in your case, I guess as you completely explained there, it's sort of the Nirvana, you know, a shift in the music scene happens while you guys are putting your project together, and then it's an entirely different focus once it's done.
Yeah, I mean, it just, and as you, I mean, we're having this interview and conversation now long enough from that point that things have turned around again.
Right.
You know, now it's back, it's kind of almost back to what it was, you know,
yeah.
where things are swinging and bluesier and more soulful are being more accepted now. And so here we go. We're full circle, you know, so it's interesting how that works. But that brought Tribute, you know, kind of out of the depths, you know, which just made me go, look, what always moved me, what always, you know, what got the hair on my neck up, you know, and this is the kind of stuff I grew up with, you know, mm-hmm. So.
What other bands were you involved with back in the, I guess the height of that would have been the early 90s. You were working in a couple of different projects. Other ones that you can remind me of?
I'm just trying to figure, you know, the Kentucky Headhunters was, we had the same management, and when the lead singer sort of had a meltdown, I almost, and did, fill in there for a while with them, and almost became the singer of that band. But I don't know what, I think I was so involved with Blue House at the time that I didn't want to shift, and it was right on the crossroads of either choosing that or keeping what I had. And in retrospect, I think I did the right thing, but it could be different if I revisited that moment, and I might have shifted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one thing, and then when we shifted gears and went into a more kind of a pop punk kind of thing with Vaporhead, which I don't really keep that on my website or have any of that flowing around, but that was one thing that I tried to shoehorn into my life, and it just didn't feel right. So we parted ways, and then it brought me to this. So,
and you spent some time in Nashville, did you not? I know you're in New York City now, or in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. But you did reside and work in Nashville. What was that like? What's your synopsis of spending time in Nashville?
It's an interesting question. I certainly don't want to give the wrong impression. I loved. I netted a couple of good friends down there. There obviously is this. Something happening down there. It's just there wasn't enough work,
right?
From what I'm used to, and I, you know, even though the cost of living is a little lower and there's a buzz and there's a little bit of a scene, it wasn't enough to keep me satisfied creatively, you know. So I moved back, you know, and since I got back, which was like 4 years ago, things have felt better.
Is there a tightly knit sort of circle of a music community down there that's hard to break?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, let's face it, I'm from the North, there is a stigma there, you know, it's not like anybody was prejudiced towards me, but I think there's a good old boy network that you have to respect down there, and people kind of take care of each other down there, and
yeah.
it's tough to bust in, but if you go anywhere, it's like that, you know, there's a circle, there's a certain click, there's a certain thing you got to break through to get consistent work, so I don't blame it on them that it's so different, and it's just that's the way it is, you know, and it's kind of a tight little community down there, yeah.
What do you make of the Nashville sound that has sort of a stigma attached to it that musicians talk about? In other words, once something gets to Nashville, it gets this cookie-cutter sort of treatment, and everything is sort of treated the same way and manufactured. Is that a reality, and did you actually sort of witness some of that up close?
I mean, I think I did. I don't know if I have the perspective to actually make a real opinion on that, you know, because,
right.
I mean, it seems that way, you know, again, there is a clicky kind of thing. There is a process, and it seems very formulated, you know,
mm-hmm.
like a mill.
Mm-hmm.
People will go down there, they'll go into a studio, and they'll cut, you know, six or seven songs in one day and pitch them to people and blah, blah. So it's definitely about the publishing. I mean, it's about placement. It's about getting things on other people's records. And there's some great writers down there and great musicians. So I'm not taking that away from anyone. But
right.
There is a certain formula and a certain ingredient to the batter that doesn't exist in New York. People write for themselves. And if it gets somewhere else, then great. You know, that's great. And it can be pitched and all that. But down there, there's an agenda. You know, there's a meaning to what they're doing, and they're trying to get this stuff to someone. And it doesn't matter if you get a song on a George Strait record that no one ever heard of, as long as you, because you can, you know, people can survive on that.
Right.
That's a lot of records that guy sells. So.
Right.
So yeah, I noticed that. But other than that, I certainly don't want to paint a negative thing on it. You know, I don't know enough about it, but I felt a little bit of that. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, let's face it. Who knows where the music industry would be without Nashville? You know what I mean? So.
Oh yeah, no, it's definitely some gears rolling down there. It's just tough to break it, you know.
No doubt. And so, okay, so this all sort of led up to Tribute. It's a recent work of yours, and one that I'm very intrigued by, and one I've wanted to showcase on this program for a while. And it's been out for a while. I guess we're going on a year now that you've had Tribute completed.
Yeah, I mean it's completed, but you know, I like my producer Doug Maxwell, who from Meteorite Productions and Visionary Media Company, is awesome, and I've been working with him for years and years and years. We both agree that it hasn't really, with everything that happened, because I went on tour right after it got released again, and it's not really released. We haven't really done a CD release party. We haven't really put it out there to everybody yet, but it is on jameslewismusicshop.com, and it can be had if people want it. That's fine, but I don't think we really officially launched it. You know,
we haven't really.
Thankfully, it's one of those records where you can do that, because it's a little bit timeless. So,
yeah.
So for my laziness, maybe I'll end up okay with it if we do an official launch and actually put this record out properly. You
know? A true labor of love, to say the least. And then I want to get into some of the details about this, because I'm, you know, we're such a, talk about a tightly knit music community. The folks that listen to this show would be interested in this kind of thing. Now, I always wonder when you put a package of cover songs together, for lack of a better term. And it's an aptly named album, Tribute. In other words, these are some of the songs that you're paying tribute to that sort of formed your musical persona, so to speak. So I always wonder, not only is it a labor of love of just something you every musician wants to do, but it's also, I'm assuming it's not free. I mean, in some cases, did you have to pay for the rights to use these songs, or did you just have to get written permission? And how does that work? Can you give us a little detail?
Yeah, I can only give you what I know, and it's like what I've learned from this is that, yeah, you have to give the artist their piece of the publishing. So, yeah, you do pay for how many units you're putting out and how many things you're, you know, what you're selling.
Right.
You got to go to them. But as far as, like, permission, no, you can actually go out and do any treatment to any of these songs that you want without permission. It's in Keep On Smiling, which is on the record, the example of that one with Jimmy Hall, I actually wanted his blessing on it because he's one of my favorite singers, and he sang on the record and played harp on the record, which I was, you know, flattered on that whole thing. But I didn't have to get permission, but I wanted it, you know, because I wanted him to feel good about it.
Right.
You know, and thankfully he did. You know?
Oh, that's awesome. So I was under the impression that an artist had to sort of approve a version of their song being released, so to speak. In other words, so none of these artists could have said, you know, I don't like the way that song was represented. I really wouldn't prefer that it's not released. That's not the case.
No, that's not the case at all, which I was, obviously, that's a great thing, because you don't have to go through negotiating whether you can put this treatment of somebody's song out. You know, you, like, for example, in Love, Rain, or Me, I mean, that song's in 6/8. We did it in 4.
Ooh.
And, you know, to a real Who fan, that might be shocking, you know, and
right. Maybe
it's hard to swallow. You know, you're either going to love it or hate it, but I didn't have to get permission to do that, you know, and that's a pretty cool thing, I guess, if you, you know, get inspired by something and then, like, just shift it around the way you want and be able to do that without going through the rigmarole, you know.
Very, very cool.
Permission. Yeah.
Very enlightening. You learn something new every day. Now, we should have played that, knowing that this little fact about 4/4 versus 6/8 on Love, Rain, or Me. We probably should have played that, but we're going to feature a couple of tunes from Tribute, and if people want to go back and hear Love, Rain, or Me, they can go to James Lewis Music Shop. Is that what it is?
Yeah, jameslewismusicshop.com. If you're, you know, if they're really curious about the 6/8/4/4 thing, they can always buy one, you know. Like, so.
That's right. Right.
Did I say that? Oh, God, I wish it was 5 minutes ago.
I didn't actually say that out loud, did I? All right, so first off, we're going to go with the lead track on this one. It's called Busted. Ray Charles performed it. Was this a Ray Charles composition? Who wrote this song?
I believe it was I'm not sure. You know what? That's funny. You caught me off guard here.
Wow.
I have to look at the publishing on it. I think it's a Ray song, but it's one of those things where, as a kid, I was really inspired by Modern Sounds of Country and Western Music, Volume 1, as a young boy, and my parents would play it all the time, and I just, that's what got me to the point where I go, you know what, this is what I want to do. And I didn't know that back then, but it was one of those things where it was so inspiring that that was the first, and you know, I just knew that that was one thing I was going to do on this record. I wasn't sure what song to pick from Ray, because he's got so many amazing songs on those two records, Volume 1 and Volume 2, but I knew it was going to be something. And that's where that came from. So that was an easy one to pick.
I'm looking at the credits on your album, and it was written by Howard Harlan. So
there you
that
go.
Was 1962. Yeah, of course you
so,
did.
You know, who I believe is a Nashville guy. Coming back to that, you know,
there you
I'm
go.
Pretty sure he's based out of there, out of that soup. So, yeah.
Well, let's get everybody a chance to hear how soulful your voice is and play Busted. This is track one from the CD, aptly titled Tribute, from James Lewis on Music Friday.
My bills are all due and the baby needs shoes. And I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted. To my brother just to ask for a loan, 'cause I was busted. Well, I hate to beg like a dog without his bone, but I'm busted. My brother said there ain't a thing I can do. My wife and my kids are all down with the flu. And I was just thinking about calling on you, 'cause I'm busted. Yeah, I'm dead broke. Yeah, I'm busted. There ain't no joke. Well, I ain't no thief, but a man can go wrong when he's busted. The food that last summer is gone and I'm busted. The fields are all bare and the cotton won't grow. Me and my family's got to pack up and go. I'll make a living just where I don't know, 'cause I'm busted. Well, I'm busted.
It's Busted from Tribute, James Lewis on Music Friday. And wow, what a powerful voice, man. So that sounds like, how different is that version, as I guess is what I wanted to say, than the original that Ray Charles did? How true to Ray's version were you?
Actually, that's it's a shift in tempo. I mean, again, that was like a 6/8, 3/4 kind of swingy track on his record. So it has a completely different treatment as far as the and landscape for the rhythm, you know. So it's quite different, actually. You know, it's kept the soul, obviously, in there, and it's swinging a little bit, but it's a completely different time signature.
Oh, okay.
That was fun to color it, you know, with a completely different rhythm.
Ray had more of like of a blues vibe going on that one, right?
Yeah, it's swinging. His is swinging a little bit more. You know, believe it. It's Ray Charles.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not going to compete with the swing factor of the Ray. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly right. You don't want to mess with that.
No, no.
So yeah, this is a good example, as we mentioned before, of your earliest influences, I suppose, and that's what sort of molded you into the singer that you are. Now, I don't know if anybody listening to that that's not familiar with you could imagine you singing in a very angst-filled sort of 90s hard rock, you know, borderline metal band, you know, but that's how versatile the voice is.
Yeah, well, I mean, Blue House, for example, it's a shame that band never saw the light of day because it was probably the best one. It did have, you know, that swampy, oily sort of blues fabric to it. I mean, it did work that way, but it was definitely heavy. I mean, it was a rock band, but it had all of the stuff that the Crows were doing at the time and other bands that were, you know, sort of had a blues influence. You know?
Right, right, right.
So a lot of that stuff pulls from everything from the Allman Brothers to Humble Pie to, you know, all these great, you know, sort of forged their way and cut their teeth for us, you know. So
where were you born and raised? Are you a native New Yorker? And who's responsible mostly for exposing you to this timeless music that you love so much?
I don't know, but if you find that person, I want to know. I'm just kidding. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay, all right.
All my family is still there, and I moved to New York so many years ago. But I kind of tramped around here for quite a while, so I feel more like a New Yorker but I know where my roots are, and it's always good to be home, and my family's pretty close, so I do get back and forth, but as far as who's responsible, I would say, you know, definitely my parents, and they didn't know it at the time, but playing all that stuff around me and the kid, it really rubbed off. You know?
Yeah.
That's where I got it, and just sort of hung on to it. I mean, you know, and I guess I had my hand in the right honeypot. I don't know. I mean, Ray Charles was, I didn't know it back then, but certainly wasn't somebody that you want to avoid. You know, I still think today it's a good idea. You know, everybody has their, whatever they're into and whatever their opinion is and whatever, I mean, you either like something or you don't. But if you want to learn how to sing and get inspired by something, that's definitely a good place to start. I can certainly say that with confidence, you know.
No doubt.
Charles is one of the best, you know.
Let's talk about, this is something I wanted to touch on with you. Let's talk about the instrument known as your voice and how natural it is and how, you know, it's just been something that's been admired and has soothed people and entertained people for all these years. It's such a romantic sort of real, natural, organic thing. And these days, it's being run through computers. And it's being manipulated and auto-tuned, and it's really, really changing the dynamic. How do you feel about that? I know we could get into that for like an hour, but you know, how do you feel about that? Is it just something that is a real sad reality about how voices are treated these days?
Well, what's my take on it? You know, again, good question. Didn't expect it, and here's my knee-jerk reaction to that.
Okay.
Last night I was watching American Idol. All right. My mom's here, the whole thing. We're watching this, we're sitting back, and I haven't seen any of the episodes, maybe just a blip here and there, and didn't really know who the singers were, and everybody's raving about this next batch of talent. And I started watching it, and quite frankly, I just was like, you know, it's interesting. They're all following technique and borrowing from certain stuff, but they're not finding out what moves them. You know, they're copying something, and they might have the ability to do that, but it doesn't work for me, you know?
Right.
And I'm not saying that they're bad singers. They're just pulling from the wrong place.
No. That's an excellent, excellent observation. You know? And I guess knee-jerk reactions are the best ones because that was very honest and true. And I, you know, I've been trying to put my finger on that. It's one thing to take something and imitate it, but they're not really, I mean, in most cases, they're not really feeling it. They're just trying to duplicate it, you know?
There's a difference between, you know, copying something and then taking something and using it, you know, honestly. And I'm not saying these people aren't great singers. But one thing you can't teach a singer, and that's pitch.
Right.
But you either have that or you don't, you know, as far as, you know, a vocal quality and a tone and a frequency and whatever that you want to call that, whatever treatment people have or whatever, however they sit, whether it's soulful or bluesy or whether it's a rock voice or an opera voice or any kind of voice at all.
Right.
If you're pulling from something, you have to eventually bring it into your own place or you're just copying somebody else's licks. And
right.
I think that's what I was getting, was like, listen, I've heard that before, and yeah, they can do it, but who cares? You know,
yep.
why am I drifting while this guy's singing, thinking about something else? That
yep.
shouldn't happen. You know?
Yeah, exactly right.
And again, not taking anything away from them, I think that just all this technology has given people something to lean on that isn't helping get the message across in an honest way.
And I think to add to that, I'll say that as the newer the generations get and the more modern the music is that they're copying, I mean, they're really, in some cases, they're copying a style that was really sort of manipulated with a computer, and now we're talking about something that's just getting away from organic completely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it goes along with how things are done, too. I mean, let's face it, it was a little more expensive to do things the way we, I guess, used to do them, but I think it's going to come around like everything else where, you know, you actually fly a guy in, put him up, bring him in the studio, go to tape, you know, hang out with the guy, create something.
Yeah.
Today, it's an awesome piece of technology, and I love it, that you can actually mail something to someone as an MP3 or send a file to someone, do your business, and not have to go in and integrate with the studio and have all those extra costs and whatever, and then send it back and put it all together. You know, it's like, okay, great, but something's missing. You know, it's like one of those things where eventually you're really losing what really makes this process fun, number one, and real.
Right.
And we got to be careful with that. We have to be careful how much we use it and how we use it. I'm worried about that, and I think that basically true music will just force it into what it's supposed to be.
Yep.
And this is a great piece of technology, but I think we're overusing it.
I think so, too, and I think it's also leading to things coming full circle, and we sort of talked about that before, and maybe, you know, bands like Blue House, maybe they should be, get, you know, take them back off the shelf and re-release them and get back to the basics,
well,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, listen, look around. I mean, people are tucking their jeans back into their boots again. You know?
Right.
I threw away, you know, 9 pairs of cowboy boots because I didn't think that would ever happen again.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, okay, it's like everything. I mean, you know, the real stuff sticks around. And to me, maybe it's old school, I don't know, but things just sound better through a Neve or an API and a 2-inch Studer. There's just no way around those mic pre's and that type of sound. You can try to duplicate it with plugins, and maybe I can't tell the difference, but there's something organic about that will never disappear. You know?
No, you're absolutely right.
And I hope it doesn't. You know, I really hope it doesn't. But
me too. And in the case of auto-tune, and coming from an engineer and producer's perspective, mm-hmm. and someone who's messed with it, it's fascinating because I'm equally fascinated by the technology that it actually works, and that you can put yourself, if you're 5 semitones off of a note, you can put yourself back on it and be perfect and go undetected. I'm equally fascinated with that as I am disgusted that we're doing it, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, sometimes, as we all know, I mean, any performance, sometimes, okay, it's a little bit off, but there's something about it that is honest and it works still.
Right.
So I'm okay with that.
Exactly.
It's like, but if you can dial it in perfectly, that's fine, but sometimes you lose a lot of the honesty and the vulnerability that you need in anything creative to get things across to people. I mean,
some of the most classic perfection. Some of the most classic notes we listen to, some of the notes that Dennis DeYoung hit in the Styx songs were flat, and some of the songs that some of the notes that Van Morrison sings in his songs are pitchy, but that's part of the magic of what those songs sound like, you know?
Right, that's true. And sometimes it's an executive decision in the studio where you go, look, I hear what you're saying, but it's still better than what we have.
Right.
And you just go with it, you know? It's like, and that's the coolness of just being out on a limb, doing stuff instead of going in and going, look, we can make that a perfect C. We can dial this in. I don't know. It just doesn't do much for me.
Right.
It's just my opinion, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
James Lewis talking to us from New York. We're exposing his album called Tribute, which was done about a year or so ago. It's a tribute to some of the greatest music that's influenced him. And so you took on the task of doing one of Greg Allman's pieces here called Queen of Hearts. Talk about how that came about and what you did differently with this song.
Well, first of all, if anybody's familiar with that song, they'll certainly hear, again, the tempo shift, you know, how it had that feel on the original track. And listening to this version, you'll hear the difference. You know, it's like a completely different shift in tempo. But the inspiration came from the fact that, you know, taking all these great singers that I was trying to choose from and picking a song from their catalog and doing a different treatment to it. Greg Allman's always been, and I'm sure there's a lot of people out there, one of my favorite singers. There's no way around that. If you like that style or genre at all, then his name's going to pop up somewhere, you know. And this particular song was a little out of my, I guess, comfort zone. So I wanted to challenge myself a little bit with something that I normally wouldn't do. And it worked. You know, I think it worked. But it was, again, a lot of guidance came from Doug Maxwell, my producer, and he took this and he basically handed him a rough piece of clay on all this stuff, and he sort of formed it into what it is. I wouldn't have been able to do any of this without his vision. So, but you'll hear the difference. And the main inspiration, of course, is Greg.
Greg's,
that's an easy thing to say, and I'm proud to say it. That guy's an animal.
Amazing voice. Yep. And you're using real cats on these tracks. We'll talk about that and make sure they get the props that they deserve. But here's Queen of Hearts from Tribute. It's James Lewis on Music Friday.
Queen of Hearts, don't tell me when to stop.
Hey now, baby, just tell me where to start. I love you, Queen of Hearts, so don't tell me where to start. Just tell me where. Tell me when, tell me when, tell me when to start. Yeah. I love you, Queen of Hearts.
Queen of Hearts, tribute. James Lewis, our guest on Music Friday, doing a beautiful rendition of a Greg Allman track there. Now, how much, let's talk about the studio process there and also give proper credit to props to the cats that played on that. How much of it was recorded live? It sounds very real. I know there's real instruments and real players there, but did you try to get more than one or two guys playing at one time and track some stuff live?
Actually, we didn't bring it in as a band, but everything is live musicians. We started out doing all the post stuff at Doug Maxwell, again, the producer and good friend. He has a studio, a post house in the city, and then he's got the same setup, a duplicate kind of setup out in Long Island where he has a live room where we recorded the drums.
Cool.
So most of the stuff was put together in the city studio, and then we did, which I was very lucky to have Sean Pelton, who played on many records and the SNL's drummer and all that stuff, play on this album. And we went out to Long Island and did the drums live, and recorded those. So they're real. Everything's real. It's just a matter of piecing it together, because we weren't quite sure how to approach all this stuff. So we laid out the landscape of all of the arrangements in the studio, and then if we had any editing to do, we did it later. But everybody was brought in one at a time. Will Lee, Beth Sussman, my good friend Keith Mack, I'm missing some, but Johnny Rosh, and of course one of the guitar players, or both of them, Alex Skolnick from Testament, played on Never in My Life, which was a tribute to Mountain. And then John Putnam, who was the kind of the glue. He really kept things together. And then background singers being Sophia Ramos and Catherine Russell from Steely Dan, which was, again, a treat to have these people even say yes, let alone try to figure out how to do it and pay them.
Wow, so, very
Let's just say there was some major favors brought up.
And after all these years, it's good to exploit those kinds of connections.
It's awesome that they even, like I said, had the time and wanted to do it. I felt lucky.
So a very respectable stable of musicians on that record. And of course, if you're curious now, after we talked about it, for that shifted time signature version of Love, Rain, or Me, you're going to have to go out and get the CD yourself. So there you go.
Oh, boy. There you go.
We did a perfect tease in that respect. So it's James Lewis tribute is the record that you want to check out. We've got the link for you on the page here for you to go right to his James Lewis Workshop Music Shop. Is that what it is? James Lewis Music Shop?
Yeah, Music Shop, yeah.
And check out his work there and get the CD for yourself. Now, every year you go out on tour with Trans-Siberian Orchestra and do a number of songs with them. So is it safe to say that, judging by how long that tour goes every year, that you're in the holiday spirit a lot longer than most people are every year?
Well, it's funny. It definitely paints a whole different thing for you, because other than being away from friends and family, it's good to have a job around that time of year. So, we're in a different little bubble, and it's a different family, but we do have a lot of fun, and it's a great bunch of people, and everyone from the management to Paul O'Neill, who kind of spearheads the whole thing and brought this whole thing out in the open, to the label, to everybody. Everybody's great. So it makes it easy to say, yes, I want to do this, it's fun, and we're out there from, we kind of get started, I guess, around the beginning of October, rehearsing and making sure all the toys and stuff work. In Omaha, we've been doing that, and then we're out by Halloween pretty much, which is early enough to be jingle belling, I think, any time before that, and wouldn't feel right. And we go pretty much through New Year's, and then by that point it starts, we're home by New Year's usually. Only one year we went past that. So
now I remember seeing Trans-Siberian Orchestra maybe 10 years ago, I guess, when my brother was doing that with you too, or before you were doing it. And you, it was theaters, smaller venues. Now you're in arenas, and it's just bigger and bigger venues, and more equipment, and more trucks. Has it leveled off? Has it leveled off to some degree?
No, it actually hasn't. And that's I don't know if it's going to. It's like one of those things where it actually gets a little bit bigger production wise and everything else every year. And for some reason, these people show up, and I just don't know where to put the demographics there. You can see a kid in the front row, you know, you start paying attention, and there's like a goth kid that's 16 years old with piercings and eye makeup and sitting there. And then right next to him is a guy in a tweed jacket that could be his English professor. And you're going, who's buying these tickets?
Right.
You know, it's like, so you have that kind of diversity and dichotomy and where the tickets are going, which makes it kind of cool because it's reaching a large range of people. And again, I scratch my head. I can't quite figure it out. You bang your head against the wall trying to sell something in the rock world all your life, and then you step into something like this and go, well, this can't work. And of course, it works.
Yeah.
So kudos to Paul. You know, Paul and I haven't really met anybody that set goals like he does and actually achieves them. You know, whatever his secret ingredient is, I think we'd all like to know what that is.
Yeah. He thinks big and gets it done. And kudos to Paul for putting it. Let's face it, the message is great. And it really gets people in the holiday spirit and on such a high energetic level. And it's always a good thing, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, people really love it. So that's all I care about.
So look for that. That's Trans-Siberian Orchestra coming to a city near you sometime in the last quarter of the year. And look for James Lewis Tribute on jameslewismusicshop.com. And take it easy on that back, man. It sounds like you need to have a little bit of rest. And normally you're a little bit more rambunctious, and I didn't want to make you laugh too hard because I don't know if it hurts to laugh at this point.
It's intense, but I think it's like I said, the road to recovery, it's better than it was. I mean, the pain's different, but it's more of an uphill instead of a downward spiral. So, one day it gets better every day.
Hey, not that I'm funny enough to make you laugh anyway. I mean, I know you have high standards when it comes to comedy, so I gotta be careful about what I pick to try to make you laugh. James Lewis, thanks for making an appearance on Music Friday. It's been long overdue, and I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me, buddy. I appreciate it. Thanks, Bill.
I look forward to hanging out with you real soon. Next time I get up north, we will do that. Hang on the phone with me for a moment while we close things off here.
Okay.
Everybody, have a great weekend. Check the links.
All right.
And get James's stuff. And we will, of course, have a new Music Friday show for you next Friday. And who knows, we may sprinkle in a few more random interviews for you during the week next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Log on each weekday for another edition of The Bill Murphy Show at BillMurphyShow.com. If you'd like to be a guest, send an email to Murph@BillMurphyShow.com. That's MURPH at BillMurphyShow.com. A Murphonics Media Production.